This is the Blaze Radio on demand.
The founder of this company 10 years ago was trying to sell his house and went through real estate agent after real estate agent, and they were all talking a great game. And this guy who is selling his house, the founder of this company, he's kind of an important guy and kind of, you know, should get the best treatment. And he said to his wife, if this is what it's like for us, how do people who have no clout ever get around this? So he started a company, and it went into business, I think, 3 years ago. Their deal is their word is their bond, and they are just like you. Now, how can I say that? Because I'm the founder of the company. We have 1,000 agents across the country, and they are people that listen to this show. And so when you go through Real Estate Agents I Trust, it's sent to somebody who already, you already know their sensibilities. They already are cut from exactly the same cloth. There's got to be a better way. There is. RealEstateAgentsITrust.com.
The more the world changes, the more we find comfort in things that never change. This is Rabbi Daniel Lapin On Demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome. I am your radio rabbi, Rabbi Daniel Lapin. And welcome to the Rabbi Daniel Lapin Show. You know, it is it's quite difficult. I've got to tell you, the truth is that I need to employ the fullest imaginative abilities that I possess to effectively record this show. I must tell you, by imagination, I mean I have to imagine clearly seeing you, yes, and you and a whole lot of you. I have to imagine seeing you all in front of me, because it is so easy to speak with a group of people. It's energizing. You find it that way. I find it that way. It's one of the reasons that hordes and hordes of counselors and therapists and psychiatrists make an enormous amount of money listening to us talk to them. Whether it's people talking about how their parents ruined their lives, or about their brothers and sisters, or about their children, or about their job. But, I've had many therapists and counselors and some psychiatrists in my congregation, and they've told me not only how much money they make, they've told me what they sit and listen to, and that very often the cure that they are promising is nothing other than a sympathetic ear, somebody to listen. Because talking is what we were created to do. We are the only species on the planet that has the capacity to speak using words as a substitute for abstract ideas. And we were created to do that. And so people who have no ability to speak are in a tremendous handicap. When I said that, you sort of heard the momentary pause there, because it occurred to me you might have thought I was talking about people who physically are handicapped and lack the capacity to speak. I actually was talking about people who don't have anyone in their lives to speak to. And here, husbands, I want to tell you that wives and husbands, women and men, have the same need to express themselves, the same need to communicate, the same need to connect. It's only that women know it. Many men do not. And much of what ails us guys could be alleviated if we felt more comfortable in speaking. Now, I'm not saying you should pour out your deepest feelings and your innermost emotions to the next innocent stranger who wanders onto your radar screen. No, but I will tell you this, that one of the very valuable functions that husbands fulfill is to be there to listen to their wives. The wives want to communicate. They want to connect. Now, what we do is we immediately hear specific problems that need solving. And our response is, well, why don't you do this? Or hold on a second, I'll go to the garage and get some tools and I'll take it. No. At that particular moment, your wife really only wants to talk with you. She's not that focused on the solution. And this is why it is that and women, you may not know this as well as guys do, but when a woman calls another woman, this is how the conversation goes. Hi, how are you? Fine, thank you. How are you? How's little Johnny? When we last spoke, he had a cold. Oh, it turned into pneumonia, and I had to keep him back from school, and so on and so forth. So it goes, and this can go on for 40 minutes. Am I mocking this? Not at all. I believe that this is one of the highest functions that we possess. I believe that communities, neighborhoods, societies, family held together because women are more comfortable communicating than men. Just figure out who is it who sends out Christmas cards and birthday cards and Hanukkah gifts and everything else in your family. Is it the man or the wife? And if yours is anything like mine, I would be isolated, alone, and completely disconnected from the world if it was not for Mrs. L. And that same thing is true for very, very many families. So so when men have phone calls, it goes a little differently. If I answer the phone and I say, hello, oh, Sam, hi, how you doing? Fine, thanks. And then Sam says to me, so how's the family? I got to tell you, I'm already starting to get a little itchy. Now, I might be excessive in this. And so if you're a man listening to me, you might not yet be relating to me. But I promise you, you're going to relate to it in just a minute, because Sam then goes on to say, is your car okay? Last time we spoke, you said that it was making a funny noise. Yes, Sam, car's just fine, thank you. Why am I getting itchy? I want to know what he called for. What was the practical purpose of his phone call? What did he need to communicate to me? What action item needs to result from this phone call? I must tell you, I don't do a lot of phone calls of just schmoozing. I just don't do a lot of phone calls of, say, how you doing? What's up? I just don't do that. Haven't got time for it. And I suspect neither do you. Men see phone calls as being action-directed, specific, focused on something that needs to be deployed or an action that needs to be taken. Women can easily have a phone call whose entire purpose is the valuable purpose of connection and communication. And it is very easy to tell neighborhoods. When you visit a neighborhood and it's a neighborhood where all the women work, you can immediately tell the feeling in that neighborhood as opposed to a residential neighborhood where there are a lot of stay-at-home moms. And the difference is the vibrancy of the neighborhood. What you see in the gardens, what you see on the streets, what you see in the parks, what you see in the local stores. It's a dead neighborhood or an alive neighborhood. And the difference is the presence of women. I tell you all of this because I was just saying that that speaking is energizing. It's life-affirming. And one of the reasons that I find museums and art galleries to be tiring, really, frankly, tiring. If there's something at a specific art gallery or museum that I want to see, I kind of like going to see it. And then I may pass a couple of things that catch my attention on the way in or the way out. But by and large, I'm done. 2 hours in a museum? No way. No, sorry, you are confusing me with another rabbi. But your rabbi, that's me, Daniel Lappin, no, not a long time in a museum at all. Doesn't happen. Why? Because I'm just having information beamed at me. I'm not getting an opportunity to respond. Do you know people who are like that? We once invited house guests to our home. A delightful couple, were very interesting, very stimulating, but it wasn't until they were in our home that we discovered that they had not the slightest shred of interest in anything about us and our lives. They were only, well, in a way, they were using us as therapists. They were talking away. And at no point did they pause even for breath. You would have thought that when they'd open their mouths to pop in a bite of dinner, that would be the opportunity for us to swoop in and get in a few words edgeways. No way. They had mastered the rare and exotic technique of being able to talk even while chewing and swallowing, which, given the anatomical structure of the esophagus, is quite hard. I mean, it's like the Louis Armstrong trick of being able to blow the trumpet and breathe in through your nose while you're blowing the trumpet. Some people literally do not have to stop talking. Well, I must tell you that Mrs. Lappin and I were so exhausted by the time they left. We just looked at each other. We were ready to collapse. And all that had happened was that we'd been talked at for 24 hours. Museums and art galleries are like that for me. One of the problems is that men in particular, again, most women are comfortable talking, which is a blessing and it's a good thing. Unfortunately, many men are verbally repressed. They're not comfortable talking. They're not comfortable expressing things. They're certainly not comfortable expressing feelings. And in the early years of most marriages, this can be frustrating for the wife because she wants to feel that deep connection, which can only come through effective verbal communication. So when I am taping this show, I have to summon up every possible image I can of you listening. And by the way, those of you who enter comments, if you're listening on SoundCloud, okay, you go on SoundCloud.com and you search for Rabbi Daniel Lappin. SoundCloud offers a place for you to put comments in. And most weeks, there's, 8, 10, 15 comments, something like that, sometimes less. And I not only read them, but I always respond to them, right? Because it helps me visualize you listening to the show, which makes it ever so much easier, because without that, it's very hard. When I was doing radio for a number of years, I did radio on a fantastic station, KSFO in San Francisco. And I wasn't living in San Francisco, but we had a very sophisticated technological studio connection that enabled me to do the show from my studio. And even when I travel, because I speak around the country, I speak for about, 20, 30 churches a year around the United States and outside sometimes. And I also speak for businesses and business organizations. And I'm going to be soon speaking, by the way, for a very interesting thing called Business Boutique. And it's coming up in May in Phoenix, and it's coming up in Dallas in May, a week apart, one weekend in Dallas, one week in Phoenix. I'm going to be appearing at both of those events. And what's so interesting about them, for women who want to become entrepreneurs, for women who want to increase their entrepreneurial abilities, for women who have dreams of doing something, maybe they want to start a business out of their homes. All of these women are getting together by the hundreds. They're going to connect and they're going to network, and we're going to have a team of very effective teachers giving hard, valuable, hands-on tools and tips and techniques that women will be able to use. Now, I'm really looking forward to that. I've never before that I can recall have spoken to, I have spoken to a women's only, now that I think about it, I've spoken to a couple of women's only events. You remember one show. A few months back, I told you about the occasion when I was invited to speak to an organization of mistresses of married men. Well, that was an entirely female audience, and quite fascinating it was, too, I can tell you. So at any rate, what I was saying is, though, that I need to imagine seeing you there. And that's one of the reasons I value your emails, and you go to my email, my website, youneedarabbi.com, and click on the contact us. And I get those emails, I read them, I respond to a number of them, and I even like to respond to some of them on the air. I might have time to do that in today's show as well. We shall see. And above all, it allows me to see you clearly. When I did the show in San Francisco on KSFO, and then before that I did shows on KVI in Seattle and KTTH in Seattle and a few other places. Those are all call-in shows, and you actually talk to me. Well, you know what talk radio is, and it's a lot of fun. As a matter of fact, if I had the technology to be able to take phone calls while taping the podcast, I really would. And I'll say this, if any of you happen to understand that technology or know how to implement it, shoot me an email, and I would gratefully appreciate your collaboration on this, because I do think the podcast could be a better show if we did have call-ins. Perhaps, you know, not all the time, but if there could be some give and take, I believe it would be helpful. Okay, so here we are, up and running, and I've had some rethinkings on something I said a few shows back. I said that I was supporting Donald Trump, and I must tell you, I've had some rethinkings on that, and I'm not as sure about that. I'm like everyone else. I think this primary season is a harbinger of not good things, but I have been disappointed by some of the things that have happened. Look, why don't I tell you about it? Coming right back.
Ancient solutions to modern problems. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
Buck Sexton.
Hillary is not a pleasant person.
I am sick of the Sanders campaign.
You're like, oh, God.
Never Hillary, everybody. Hashtag never Hillary. I mean, I'm not one. I don't have any tattoos, but if I get one, it's going to have to say never Hillary. Because that's how dedicated to this idea I am. Never Hillary.
Buck Sexton. Weekdays, noon to 3 p.m. Eastern on the Blaze Radio Network.
With stories in the areas of family, friendship, faith, and finance, this is Rabbi Daniel Lappin. Only on the Blaze Radio Network on demand.
Okay, here we go. You know, I often wonder, I mean, do I really need to start each segment by saying, hey, this is Rabbi Daniel Lappin. You're on the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show. Welcome to the Rabbi Daniel. Like, where would you think you were? That's what you're listening to. That's what you're tuned into. So maybe we can save time and just do away with that redundant intro and just move right into the topic. Okay, look, here is a letter I got, which is typical of, literally, if I tell you dozens of letters, I'm not exaggerating. Dozens means at least 24, right? I'd say more like double that, more like 50 letters. And very typical is this, and they're all lovely letters, by the way, but here is this one. Hi, Rabbi Lappin. I certainly hope this critical feedback doesn't affect our friendship. By the way, I don't know this gentleman, but I appreciate the, I love friends, and the more friends, the better. Thank you for responding before. Oh, okay, that's right. So he wrote to me on something else, and as I've told you often, I respond to a good portion of the letters I get, and I responded briefly, so we're friends. As non-Jews with a love for Torah, we value your connection more than you may realize. I just listened to the Money is Time podcast where you support Trump at the end. Maybe you've heard all this before, but I'd like to respond to the points I remember. You didn't vote against Obama. I did. I just didn't vote. I didn't vote for John McCain, who I believe to be a deeply flawed human being and politician. I did vote for Romney very reluctantly because I knew he was going to lose, his own fault. Just to correct that, Jason. Then he continues, Hillary and Trump are far more similar than Obama was to his opponents, which is why my wife and I will not be voting for Trump if, God forbid, he is the nominee. At least feckless, quisling Republican politicians will oppose a Democratic leftist for fear of re-election. The same is not true if the leftist is an R, hello, universal health care, is a Republican. I'm not sure I get that. We need a tough... Say, now he goes to my next point. We need a tough guy, a thug even, to deal with Hillary. What if that thug goes on to use his dirty tricks to advance his leftist positions? Now he goes to my next point. Ex-wives don't speak out against him. You may say yourself that one can learn most of what one needs to know about a man by how he treats women. I'm not sure I would agree with that at all. Does he call them pigs or insult their face or reference their menstrual cycle or brag about his past adulteries and future targets while married? Or notify a wife of his marital exit via tabloid, or verbally denigrate a female reporter who was physically harmed by his campaign manager. You don't actually believe that a thug's divorced wives only keep quiet because of his hidden virtue. Okay, millions of dollars spent to stop Trump. Is it admirable if Trump spends large sums of his own money to promote himself, but questionable if others do the same to oppose him? Well, by the way, I think it's questionable if it's Republicans who do the same thing to oppose him. In other words, these are Republicans who apparently do not very much like the word democracy. And so what they like is when everybody votes for the person they're fond of, but when people vote for somebody they're not fond of, like Donald Trump, well, all of a sudden democracy is not quite the same. The party is trying to stop democracy, he said. Democracy, by definition, is majority rule. Trump has not and will not have majority popular support. If he gets to 1237, it'll be in spite of democracy. Cruz, on the other hand, has won states by large majorities, and hopefully democracy will prevail. The good people running cannot deal with Hillary's dirty tricks. Well, there's now only one good choice left. Trump loses in national polls to Hillary. National polls now about a Trump-Hillary like are completely meaningless, by the way. I can refer you to a number of very important articles that that really understand the polling technology to show that that's rubbish. The vetting is yet to begin. It'll take more than his own dirty tricks to save Trump. Trump is a cronyist, a man of the left who has made a living from casinos and strip clubs and has attempted to use government to advance his interests. He is as you teach a horse without a rider. Let us raise a standard to which the wise and honest can repair. The rest is in the hands of God. George Washington. My dear Jason, if we were in the days of George Washington, I would probably agree with much of which you write. If we had running an Adams, if we had running a Jefferson, if we had running a Ben Franklin, then I don't think we'd be having this conversation. But we're not! We don't have those people! It'll take courage to oppose Trump, but I hope you'll reconsider your support. Thank you for the insightful application of time. And he comments about the other part of the show. Thanks. Signed, Jason. Okay, fine. Look, let me tell you something. There was an 18-year-old girl. Her name was Mimi Beardsley. And One day, she was working as an intern in the White House, by the way. And one day, young girl, she had just begun working. She was a college girl. She had just begun working in the president's press office. And she met the president. And the president said, "Can I give you a personal tour around the White House?" Okay, he's just met her. She's just started work there. She's an intern. It's during the summer, and then she's going back to college. And so while the staff were drinking cocktails just down the corridor, the president led her into his bedroom where he started taking off her clothes and didn't say a word. When she momentarily resisted his advances, the president said, "Oh, haven't you done this before?" To which she replied, "No." He continued anyway, she says, and on the ride home that afternoon, it kept echoing in my mind, "I am no longer a virgin." She's now a 69-year-old grandmother, and she's come out with us. And I was going to ask you, who do you think the president is, right? You might have guessed Clinton. It was actually John F. Kennedy. She tells of a party at the ranch of Crosby when somebody passed around a tray of the sex drug amyl nitrate. She writes that the president asked her if she wanted to try it. "I said no," she recalls, "but he just went ahead and popped the capsule and held it under my nose. I ran out of the room crying." As to why she allowed the affair to happen, which, by the way, went on for many months, a year and a half, as to why she allowed it to happen, she says, "The fact that I was being desired by the most famous and powerful man in America only amplified my feelings to the point of where resistance was out of the question." And look, the idea of how can we have a president who has who isn't faithful to his wife, folks, that ship sailed in 1962, okay? We don't even have to go back to Clinton. We can go back much further than Clinton. That ship has sailed. America is at an advanced stage of decadence, decay, and depravity. Do I need to tell you that again? America is at a seriously advanced stage of decadence and depravity. This was 1962. We had a president who not only committed adultery with married women, but seduced and debauched an innocent teenager in the White House. And many, many more disgusting things went on with Mimi Beresford, who then later went on to marry, and her married name was Beardsley. And by the way, she speaks of the fact that she believes that much sorrow and unhappiness was brought into her life. She had always wanted to go into marriage pure. And you know what it's like when deep down you have a feeling that you've been, you know, that you're wrong, you're corrupted, you have a sense of moral self-loathing. It changes things. And there's no question that Mr. Beardsley got a very different wife from the sort of wife he thought he was getting and hoped he was getting, probably. There is a big difference. And those of you who have married virgins, those of you, particularly those of you who, for whom in your marriage you each were one another's first sexual partner, you know of what I'm talking. There is something very, very different. And when ancient Jewish wisdom says that in the marriage bed of a woman who has had other partners, that there are always three people, I think you can understand that. It really changes. So here's a man who really damaged the life of a young woman callously. By the way, he was never nice to her. He was never kind to her. Anyway, my point is to Jason and everyone else who wrote to me saying, "Oh, he's had three wives and he's an adulterer and he speaks about women." People, we've had presidents like that already. Stop it. Stop it. It's like you're clutching your pearls and raising your head to your hand to your brow. And you say, "Oh, I'm so shocked." What about Mr. Trump shocks you? I mean, stop pretending to be a wilting violet. Look where we are in America today. And in any event, I don't understand what the importance of that is. Would it be nice? Would it be nice if we could have a man of honor like General Washington? Yes. Yes, it would be one. Look, I'd be delighted to have Calvin Coolidge. I would love to. But there is a steady downward deterioration in America since about 1960. I've discussed this with you in great depth, and I think many of you enjoyed that and appreciated it. If your emails are anything to go by, I've explained in previous emails how America has slid down the slope of secular fundamentalism and deteriorated, And yes, we are in a state of decadence and depravity, serious decadence and depravity. Now, take the pastor you most respect. I'm not going to mention a name because I have many dear friends who are truly, truly good church leaders. And I must tell you that if somebody gave me the option of putting one of them in the White House, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it. Look, would it be nice if your son and my son are led into battle in the military by General George Washington? That would be terrific, wouldn't it? But if that's not an option, if your son is in the military and the choice is his being led into battle by your favorite rabbi or pastor. Now, I'm going to drop the rabbi. Your favorite pastor, or by General George Patton. And I come to you and say, what? You can't let your son be led into battle by a foul-mouthed adulterer like General Patton. It's out of the question. Why would you do a thing like that? You may not do that. You need your son to be led into battle by a godly man like George Washington. Look, General George Washington's not around anymore. Warfare is different now. And if you want your son to come back home, your best chance is that he's being led by a General George Patton who reveled in killing the enemy, who said, your job is not to die for your country, but to make the other guy die for his country. That's the sort of guy who I would like to lead me into battle or my son into battle. Will I take moral lessons from him? Of course not. Don't you see that we're in a state of battle now? We really are. We're in a state of serious battle now. And you're telling me, you're talking to me about the moral abilities of, for heaven's sake, that ship sailed in 1960 to be exact, when Kennedy was elected. That's gone already. Do you not understand just how bad things are in this country? Do you really think that the most important qualities of the guy who has to lead us into battle, I hope, to restore the Republic and bring back the America we knew and loved? Do you really think the most important qualities are his virtue and his morality? I wish it were so. And I will tell you this, that if the president becomes, let's say it's Trump, and let's say against all predictions and odds, he really does begin to turn America around, and he has 8 years to do it in, and then he's followed by another president who does another 8 years. And by the way, 16 years is an absolute minimum for getting things right. And, you know, you just think about, you know, the fact that why the Israelites had to die in the desert, and I'll explain that. You'll see why it takes a generation to get things right. Even if all of that happens, then, well, why don't I tell you that, coming right back. And I know you'll go to my website because I want to hear from you, right? RabbiDanielLappin.com. Be back in a moment.
There's still more to come from Rabbi Daniel Lappin on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
Jay Severin.
Trump says women who have abortions may face punishment. Does he realize that he's telling us, I'm against Roe versus Wade, I am now pro-life, and unlike most people who are pro-life, not a lot of people believe that the woman who gets an abortion ought to be punished.
Jay Severin, weekdays 3 to 5 p.m. Eastern on the Blaze Radio Network.
We now return with Rabbi Daniel Lappin on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
We're back, and I don't have to say welcome to the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show, because you know that's where you are, and I know that's where I am. Why generation? Well, just think about it. There was a reason that before the Israelites could enter their own land, battle the occupants of their land, and establish their own society and their own land, although they were taken out of Egypt, Egypt still had to be taken out of them. Do you get it? And so 40 years in the desert, the entire generation, anybody who was alive in Egypt had to die before they could go into the land of Israel. Look, you can take people away from socialism, but you can't take socialism out of people so easily. And just think about what happens when you try to take stuff away from people. It's a principle in child raising. It's a principle in business. It's a principle in politics. Once the horse is out of the stable, very, very difficult to get him back. Once you are giving away stuff, taking it back takes a long time, very long time, because if you try and do it quickly, it wipes out your political career and the country's back to where it was. The great Margaret Thatcher, Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, was impatient at one point and tried to bring about change that involved reducing socialism, reducing redistribution of wealth, and not surprisingly, that brought about the end of her political career. So even if Donald Trump gets elected, and even if, against all probability and prediction, he goes ahead and begins the roll back and begins the process. And like I said, it's going to take a pattern, a general pattern, not a pastor or a priest. By the way, one of my disappointments with the current pope, as opposed to Pope Benedict, who was a man who understood how the world really works, and he was a leader who was willing to do and say unpopular things. But even if Trump succeeds and does all these things, and then the one after him is another 8 years, and miraculously again doing, and Congress allows it, and people go along, and the country is now well on its way back to a great America, an America where color is completely irrelevant, where black people do not get favorable treatment, and women do not get favorable treatment, and white people don't get favor, and just complete justice and fairness and equivalency for everybody in the eyes of the law. Well, that would be terrific. And then, at that point, 16 years from now, or 20 years from now, at that point, if we seek a godly man for president, I'm with you. I'm with you 100%. But when we are in a very bad situation, we're under fire, both literally and morally, don't forget what 9/11 represented, what it really was. You know, you can't forget that they launched an attack on America that killed over 3,000 Americans, and that there's been a constant, I mean, nobody pays any attention anymore. The president is barely moved by the San Bernardino slayings. So we're under fire, physically, literally, and we're also under fire morally, where the moral fiber of the country has been eroded so seriously that you have an entire segment of the population that for more than one generation is living on the sweat of their fellow citizens, where welfare has become a way of life for large numbers of our population. All of that has to be fixed. A return to constitutional values. What do I mean by that? You got to ask, on what basis does the federal government take my money and your money in order to save endangered species, or in order to find national standards of education, or for there to be a Department of Agriculture that takes our money to give to other people, to farmers in this case? Look what's going on. Now, is Trump the guy who's going to be able to do all that? I don't know. But I know that Hillary Clinton is only going to do more of it. And so you might say, well, then why not vote for Ted Cruz? And I know Ted Cruz, not well, but I like him. I think he'd be a terrific attorney general. I'd love to see that happen. or even on the Supreme Court eventually. I'd love to see that. But I am not sure. Now, by the way, let me just stress, polls now about who can beat Hillary are completely nonsensical and meaningless. And anybody who reads articles that are written by people who understand polling will quickly be able to learn to pay no attention. You know, a lot of it is wishful thinking. Oh, he can't beat Hillary this way. Oh, he can beat Hillary. It's complete nonsense. There is no way of knowing that now. Polls are utterly unreliable on that fact. And so it's really just a question of your best guess and my best guess. And like I told you a few weeks ago, my best guess was, and I used the word thug, and I realized afterwards I probably shouldn't have. I meant it in a positive way. I know that sounds like a pathetic attempt at trying to make lemonade out of lemons here. But what I meant was, you know, all the qualities that people criticize, you know, he's a bully, he's a friend, he's all this. And I used the word thug, meaning that it was somebody who would be able to strong arm the people who are trying to cheat him. Because I think there's going to be voter fraud on the Democratic side. Why should this year be different? I think there absolutely will be. And I think it's going to take somebody who is very good. Again, in years gone by, there was voter fraud in the first place in 1960 that got John F. Kennedy into power. But Nixon was a gentleman. I'm not sure that was a good thing. I think Nixon in his mind was living in an earlier America where that was appropriate and wonderful. But under the circumstances, I think he did a big disservice to the country letting Kennedy come in. I really do. So I use the word thug about Trump. And I realize that I want to walk that one back and apologize for that. And I'll tell you why. I realized that if I met him and he said to me, "So you called me a thug," I'd be embarrassed. Because under those circumstances, you don't really have the opportunity to give a semantic explanation of precisely what you meant by the use of the word thug. It's a negative word, and that's all there is to it. So it's hard to walk back from it. But I certainly said, and I felt at the time, that he stood the best chance of being able to beat Hillary. And everybody wrote into me, not everybody, but a bunch of people wrote into me, "Oh, he's terrible, and do you really think that he's a conservative?" Look, I don't know if he's a conservative, but I think he is more conservative than Hillary. Why do I say that? Because he's a pragmatic businessman. If he understands business, he's already ahead of Hillary. Because business, the idea of human beings engaging in voluntary exchange in order to both better their material circumstances, that is part of God's plan for humanity. Hillary would like to utterly wipe out the private sector. Her ultimate dream is a socialist paradise where everything is government controlled. I know that's no good. I know that's what Hillary plans. Whereas with Trump, at least, it's a question mark. Now, it's not great to choose between a question mark and a dead certain destruction, right? It's like, but we are on a sinking boat. And there are two life boats, and neither of them look in good shape. But one of them I can see daylight through the hull. I see that one is going to sink. The other one might have a hole and might not. It doesn't look in great shape. Come on, folks. You're not on the Queen Mary. You're not on the Carnival cruise. You're on a sinking boat. And there's two lifeboats. They're both problematic, except one is for certain going to sink, and the other one may sink, may float. Go for that one. It's all the choice you have. There is no other ship to step onto. There is nothing else. Well, people say, well, there's Ted Cruz. And maybe so. And when I said that I was engaging in some rethinking, what was I talking about? Well, I was talking about the fact that I have been very disappointed recently. Not by the Corey Lewandowski. By the way, I admire Trump for standing by him. Corey Lewandowski did not in any way at all deserve to have his life destroyed for what happens. Right? I really want people to understand that. And so Trump standing by him is very good. You'll remember it was 1968 in Los Angeles when Robert Kennedy was shot to death. What was Robert Kennedy at the time? He was a senator, but he was a presidential candidate, you will remember, right? And he was shot to death where? In exactly the same kind of crowd that you saw on the videos surrounding Donald Trump, and in the middle of which was Michelle Fields approaching Trump and doing something that you're not supposed to do to presidents or presidential candidates, because from Kennedy, Robert Kennedy's assassination, Congress passed legislation for Secret Service protection for candidates. And one of the rules is you don't touch the candidate, right? Ronald Reagan was shot in the same way in a press crowd. When a hand comes out reaching towards a president or a presidential candidate, Secret Service is supposed to stop that, right? Hands reaching towards the president constitute a threat. And Lewandowski reacted in the way most normal people would in that situation, but in so doing, he made himself vulnerable. And I have to tell you that I think he's being lynched. I really do. Is he a priest? Is he a pastor? Is he a professor of morality and ethics? No, he's a campaign guy, right? I'm not going to use the T word. Well, it's a thug profession. And Michelle Fields is a big girl. She's a journalist. She knows as well as anybody, you're pushing through the crowd trying to get to the candidate. You reach out towards him. You know, if it wasn't Lewandowski, it would have been a Secret Service. Somebody would have pulled her back, no question about it. And what's going on here is truly nothing but a lynching. Frankly, I find it disgraceful that Republicans are jumping on that bandwagon. I really do. And I find the behavior of the Republican establishment towards the Trump candidacy to be quite lamentable. And Trump standing by Lewandowski, good for him. Absolutely good for him. It shows his loyalty, and frankly, it makes me like him as a candidate more, because he's not being politically correct, and above all, he's not being influenced by the braying hounds. He's not being influenced by the hyenas laughing outside in the night. He is doing what he does. He's being Trump, for better or for worse. And I know I'm not alone in admiring that. But if that's the case, why do I have second thoughts? Why am I concerned about Trump and now just unsure of where I stand on that particular matter? I'll tell you why, coming right back.
Revealing how the world really works. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin, on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
The Jeff Fisher Show.
The Library of Congress put some new entries in. The library's National Recording Registry, which aims to preserve sound recordings that have great cultural and historic importance to the United States. The oldest edition this year is Let Me Call You Sweetheart by the Peerless Quartet from 1911. All-time classic, right? I mean, who didn't have a grandfather that would sing that? Let me call you sweetheart. Oh, yeah, come on.
The Jeff Fisher Show. Saturday morning, 6 to 8 Eastern on the Blaze Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Blaze Radio Network On Demand with Rabbi Daniel Lappin.
Back together again, and why have I had misgivings and concerns? Look, I know that there is a campaign sign hanging in headquarters of Trump, which I think is very clever. The sign it's not for the public, it's for the workers on the campaign. It's for the people who are helping him and on the ground. And the sign reads, "Let Trump be Trump." I get it. I can't tell you how refreshing I personally find it to have somebody running for president who does not need a teleprompter. I mean, have you seen some of those hilarious videos where the teleprompter fails on Obama and he's lost for words? And I'm not saying that Obama can't talk without a teleprompter. I'm saying that when a man or a woman talks without a teleprompter, they are more likely to reveal what's in their hearts than what was in the minds of their speechwriter. And that's why I would be very loath to go into business with somebody or to get in any way connected or involved with somebody who only issues prepared statements, but who never ever speaks from the heart. Note to listeners, I am not reading this show from a prepared text. I'm speaking from the heart, with all the peril that brings, by the way. Not only does it involve exposure of self on a very intimate level, but it also means that you are more likely to have to apologize and retract things you say, because when you speak extemporaneously, there are things that you say that are on your heart right then that you haven't had a chance to evaluate and carefully contemplate. And when you do, you say, you know what, I was wrong on that one. And so it's very refreshing to see a guy who is not being micromanaged, whose image is not constantly being reshaped by media consultants and by political consultants. He is who he is. At the same time, it sure would be nice if he would take some advice. There got to be people on his team who could say to him, you know, you got to prepare a speech just a little bit more. I get it, no teleprompter. I get it, you speak from the heart. But you need more words. Right, you can't allow yourself to be a subject of satire by having a limited vocabulary where the superlatives flow, but they're always the same superlatives. That is a problem. That's not a great thing. So he's not listening to people on that front. He's not listening to people. And again, there've got to be smart people on his campaign. I don't know anybody that I'm aware of, but there've got to be people, competent, smart people, who could say to him and should say to him, and maybe they do say to him, boss, it's now time. At this point, you are coasting along. You're doing great. You, at this point, you have to start sounding more presidential. You've got to sound like you're a bigger man. The right response to something that happens is not, I'm going to sue, right? You're a big boy. And so if Ted Cruz outplayed you on the ground by having people down there going to talk to the delegates that you won and to talk them into voting for him, then he outplayed you. The answer should not be, well, I'm going to sue. Okay, you've got to start looking a little different. And up till now, I have been excusing you and forgiving you because I believed that what you were doing was a little bit, I mean, it was you, but that you were also capable of more mature behavior. It was you, and that at the appropriate moment, you would start looking mature, looking like a big human being, somebody who doesn't jump at every insult, somebody who doesn't resort to low-level name-calling. I don't mean that in any way you should diminish the intensity of your fight. I don't mean that in any way at all you should not be going after your opponents. And I'm not even saying that you should be less vicious or less thuggy or less, you know, but there's a way of doing it that comes across as presidential. There's a way of speaking and there's a way of appearing that begins to reclaim some of the dignity that is your natural legacy. And that is a part of running for the people's house, the White House. So I, at this point, would love to see signs that he's capable of learning. I think we all need to be capable of learning. I don't think I know a single human being or ever have known a single human being about whom I'd say, well, he's got it all. He doesn't need to learn anything. Right? We all need a great deal of learning, some of us even more than others. But even Donald Trump, and I get it. I get the ego is part of the appeal. I had thought it was part of the game. I thought it was part of the role he'd created, which was working well. We do like affiliating with a winner. We do like associating ourselves with somebody who seems to have a clear idea of where he's going. And by the way, you know, a Trump that isn't a master of policy, that's fine with me. I think that some of the Republicans who've been attacking him because he doesn't know how he hasn't told us the policies that he's going to do this, that, that's stupid. That is just all stupid. I give no meaning to that. And, you know, and when a candidate does come up, oh, these are my detailed policies, you're a fool if you believe that, because it has no bearing with what he's actually going to do. So why does it matter to you? When a man becomes president, or a woman for that matter, becomes president, that person has access to the finest minds, the best talent, the most knowledgeable people. Do you know how many thousands and thousands and thousands of policy wonks live in the within 100 miles of Washington, D.C., who would love jobs in the next administration? There's no shortage of people who can figure out policy. What you need is somebody who sets the tone. And I'm disappointed by those of us who in our country who have been fooled by some of this criticism again. Oh, he doesn't have the policy at his fingertips. He may know what he wants to do, but he doesn't know how he's going to achieve it. Yeah, hello. Absolutely. General Motors knows how many cars it wants to sell in 2017. I promise you they don't quite know how they're going to achieve it yet. Right? This is always true. You get in the White House and there's a transition period, and you've got access to people who very quickly can put together the policies you need, as long as you have the vision. Ronald Reagan at this time in the campaign in 1980, I assure you, could not have answered what is the method by means of which he's going to end the Soviet Union. He didn't know it yet. Had no idea. He didn't. The Strategic Defense Initiative, which was dubbed the high frontier, or Star Wars, they called it. He didn't have that all worked out yet. He didn't have to. And so that in itself doesn't worry me about Mr. Trump. What it does do is make me worry greatly about the rest of Republican leadership and the state of the country. But then again, we've got a country where people docilely stand in line for an hour before getting on a flight, while a raucous TSA employee, which, by the way, the TSA, one of the greatest union plays in American history, shame on you, George W. Bush, while a raucous TSA employee marches up and down yelling at you about what to do with your computer. Frankly, I'd like to tell him what he should do with a computer. It's disgusting, but it shows a docile quality to America that emphasizes what I said earlier. We are a people that is in an advanced state of decadence and depravity. And the notion that we need a priest or a pastor, we need a godly man to pull us out of it. Sorry, wrong. Absolutely wrong. At this point, as somebody who believes that the erosion of Judeo-Christian faith in America, the erosion of the Bible, the erosion of Christianity in America has been a calamity of limitless consequence, my worry is not how will we get a president in 2016 who's going to restore the Bible to its place of primacy and who's going to put a Ten Commandments statue back in the parks of America. No, that's not the problem at this stage of the game. That's like telling George Patton in the later stages of the European war against the Nazis. Do you know that there are some towns in America where you cannot get chocolate ice cream? Hello, we got a war to win first. And we're in exactly that situation here. We have a war to win. And the war, frankly, right now, is the growth of the federal government. Now, like I said before, the two lifeboat analogy. Do I know that Donald Trump is going to cut back the federal government? No, I don't know that. I think he might, because as a pragmatic businessman, he must understand deep down within him somewhere that things are better done by business than by government. Most things. Not everything, most things. If I'm wrong, well then, I gambled and I lost, but my only other choice was Hillary Clinton, who without doubt is going to expand the power of government. Freedom doesn't stand a chance as long as government cannot be rolled back. Will Trump do it? I'm not sure. I hope so. Will Hillary? Absolutely not. How's about Ted Cruz? I think he probably would. And if he wins the nomination, I will joyfully support him. But I'm not sure he'd beat Hillary. Now, again, no polls on this are of any value right now. But the only thing I know is that the hunger for power that the Clinton team has, the sheer audacity and recklessness with which they pursue impunity while possessing power, tells me that there are going to be dirty tricks galore beyond anything we've ever seen before. Now you tell me, who do you think is better equipped to deal with dirty tricks? Ted Cruz or Donald Trump? Now, I've seen some things that Ted Cruz has done lately, and they've been dirty tricks, or close to it, I think. Maybe not exactly, but close. And you know what? It doesn't make a difference to me. Let me tell you why, because you can't beat a professional at his own game. If I tried to become a casino operator, believe me, I could do it. Right, there'd be a lot of adjustment, a lot of learning. I'd have to get a lot of helpers, but at the end of the day, with all that, I still would not be successful. You know why? Because it's not in me. It's not who I really am. I have such a strong, deep-seated belief that gambling is bad for human beings and it's bad for a society, that if you have me in charge of your casino, I do my best and I do an adequate job. But I would advise you to get somebody who believes in gambling. Ted Cruz may or may not have engaged in some dirty tricks, but even if he did, he does not believe in them. He doesn't believe in them. And he's not going to be as good at it as somebody who does. That all said, I do remain concerned. I remain intensely disappointed that at this stage in the campaign, Donald Trump has not yet displayed an ability to learn, even to learn from his own mistakes, but to learn from his own paid advisors, and has not been able to display a maturity, and has not been able to display a presidential quality to himself. I find myself thrown into concern, and I'm just not sure that I feel quite as comfortable saying, you know what, he's the guy. I just don't know right now. But I will watch, and week by week, I will continue to let you know my feelings on that. And President Obama recently said that the biggest threat facing America is the environment, the environmental crisis, climate change. Yes, he really did. I know it sounds bizarre, but he really did. So, and of course, everybody reacted predictably. So in a world that has ISIS, in a world in which the economy is in terrible shape in America, in a world in which the Chinese are eating us for breakfast, the biggest threat facing America is climate change. Now, I think there are a lot of flaws in Mr. Obama. I think there are a lot of flaws. I don't think he's by any means as brilliant as people think. I don't think he's as good a speaker as people think. I think he's a terrible speaker when you take the teleprompter away. I think he tends to be a very lazy man. And above all, I think he tends to be a very arrogant man. Those are the human flaws I see in this man. However, I don't think he is without intelligence. And so the question is, how can anybody but a complete cretin, how can anybody but a complete imbecile, how can somebody but a complete moron believe that, yes, the biggest threat facing America in 2016 is climate change? That is the question I wish to answer for you in just a moment, coming right back.
Ancient solutions to modern problems. This is Rabbi Daniel Lapin, on demand on the Blaze Radio Network. Don't miss Pat and Stu.
We'll share the surprising psychology behind rock, paper, scissors.
And we'll tell you all about the awful, devastating, no-good decline of Chipotle. Right. Or as Al Sharpton calls it, Chipotle.
I honestly don't care what's going on at Chipotle. I'm willing to risk my health for a burrito. In fact, I think most people risk their lives when they order burritos.
Pat and Stu, weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern on the Blaze Radio Network.
Welcome back to Rabbi Daniel Lapin On Demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
Let me start off by telling you a little bit of Jewish history regarding immigration to this country. Now, what I'm telling you is simply a material with which I am familiar. The same thing would be able to be told by Christians, if not in America, then in other countries. What I'm talking about is where faith demands an extreme sacrifice. And very often a sacrifice that makes no sense to anybody else. And so let me describe to you a story that happened repeatedly. The family law is filled with these accounts. I mean, almost every family, I know myself, so many families that have this story, that know it from, and we're not talking about many generations back, 1920s, right? So, you figure that out, and somebody who was, shall we say, in their 30s in 1920, would now be 130. Okay. So, they would have been raising children during the 50s, 60s, 70s, and those people are now middle-aged, and they've got children who are adults. So the point I'm making is that I know many people, and I'm not alone in this. You could speak to many Jewish people. But you'd want to find Jewish people who are committed to the Bible and who take the faith of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob seriously, not people who are ethnically Jewish, like George Soros, but who bow at the altar of secular fundamentalism. But if you found Jews who take the tradition and the law seriously, then you would almost inevitably be able to talk to people who know how their grandparents fared when they arrived. So the point is, 1920s, lots and lots and lots of Jews arrived on the shores of America. Many of them arrived in Galveston, and I frequently speak in Dallas, and I speak for the Jewish community. There are a couple of synagogues I speak at fairly regularly in Dallas, and people come up to me and talk to me about these stories. Their grandparents came to America through Dallas. much bigger numbers came through New York and settled on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, near where the Brooklyn Bridge is, near where the Manhattan Bridge is. And here's what happened. In a previous podcast, just a few weeks back, I spoke about Sabbath in the Lappin family. I didn't speak of any sacrifice involved in the fact that I don't do any work from sunset on Friday until Saturday night. And the truth is, what an incredibly blessed life I live, that I can remain faithful to the requirement that my boss has of me, which is that I do not work on the Sabbath, on the Shabbat, from Friday night. And I can't really say that it costs me anything at all. I mean, I really can't see of any way in which it costs me. Now I'm fortunate. I'm not working by the hour. I'm not working in a factory right now. I've worked for Philips, a Dutch electronics company. My point is that when these immigrants arrived in America in the teens and 20s, they came from Germany, they came from Poland, they came from Russia, they came from Lithuania, they came from Latvia, mostly from Eastern Europe. They didn't know English, and there was no English as a second language programs here, the welfare program, no, nothing like that. No work, no eat. No speak English, no get job. So they learned pretty darn quickly. And they went to night school. The immigrant organizations had night school. And they worked on getting their English. And they walked the streets in the day getting a job. And they'd get a job comes Friday afternoon, particularly in winter, right? Because sun goes down at 4 o'clock, 4:30, it's time for the Shabbat. And he goes to his boss. This new immigrant just finally gets a job, able to support himself and his family. And he says, I'm sorry, I can't work, but I'll be available Sunday morning. Loses the job. This story was heartbreaking. It was told over and over and over again. Of these men who came back to their families on Friday afternoon, supposed to be happy and ready to celebrate the Sabbath in joy and in harmony and tranquility, and instead they have to disclose to their wives and children that they're out of work again. And, Sunday morning, back on the streets looking for a job and hoping this time to maybe find one with somebody who will let them not work on Sabbath. And they'd say, we'll work on Sunday, we'll work in the nighttime, we'll do anything you want. Look, this is how it was. And this is how it is to right now. There are Jews in America, there are Jews in Europe, there are Jews in Israel. And I'm not saying the majority of Jews take Sabbath seriously. It's not true. It's a small minority. Maybe 15-20%. I'd be happy if it was as much as that, but that's about it of all the people who self-identify as Jews. But you go up to these people and offer them a sum of money that will literally change their lives on condition that they work on Saturday. And in the overwhelming majority of cases, they'll say no. Do you have any idea of how amazing that is? And as I said, I know that there are Christians in different times of history and in different places who have made ultimate sacrifices for faith. Okay, but this is what I'm personally familiar with. Do you know how expensive kosher meat is? It's substantially more expensive than non-kosher meat. There's a lot of reasons for that, but regardless of the reasons for the moment, bottom line is, somebody comes to me and says, Lappin, do you know how much discretionary cash you would have available if you switched to non-kosher meat? Have Mrs. Lappin go to the regular butcher at the market and just buy regular meat. You'll be shocked how much money you'll save. And if you take that money and invest it, you'll make some, it'll be very good. Here's a simple, simple way of increasing your revenue, your standard of living, your security. This is a good thing to do, right? Who wouldn't want to do it? But they're wasting their breath. I could not do that. I could as easily get a non-kosher hamburger down my throat as I could digest a handful of number 10 nails. Construction nails, the nails that people use for framing a house. No, it's not doable. I know what would happen. If I try to put a non-kosher piece of meat in my mouth, it would be like I feel a steel claw would wrap itself around my neck. I wouldn't be able to swallow. I'd want to gag. Okay. But that's, you know, that's after many years. But I think that would be true even for, you know, for kids who've been raised with the kosher laws, the Old Testament dietary rules. So anyways, what's my point? My point is that logic has nothing to do with it. You could give me the most logical argument of why the Lappin family should switch to non-kosher meat, and we'll tell you, as much as I'm a guy who loves a steak and a plate of fries, I would become a vegetarian before. So it's not, you know, it's not because I'm a big saint or anything. I'm not, far from it. It's just that this is an important part of my faith, and too much of my connection with God and too much of my identity as a person is wrapped up in that. You know, and again, like I said, for me, observing the Sabbath, I'm so blessed, I'm so fortunate. It's a joy, it's no hardship at all. But it's only three generations ago that Jews suffered terribly in order to avoid working on the Sabbath. They lost jobs, which is a terrible, terrible tragedy. I got into a lot of trouble, A number of years ago, you might remember a manufactured, man-made crisis in the Northwest, right, in the Pacific Northwest, and the spotted owl was going into extinction. By the way, spotted owl was not going into extinction. Spotted owl is numerous and plentiful. I've seen them myself many times. Not a problem. However, on the basis of that, the environmental movement cut back the logging, costing thousands of jobs, many, many men who knew the only skill they had was logging, right? You know the logging industry in the state of Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia is like the, that's where most of the wood came from. People said, there was a very, very large public speech once. After my speech, there was questions and answers. And you know those situations where they have microphones down in the hall and people come up to the microphone and said, some guy comes up and says, you seem to think the jobs of loggers are more important than that the environment should continue to have spotted owls. Do you realize that spotted owls play a vital role in the preservation of the environment? And he said, so what do you got to say to that? And so, again, look, I don't have a teleprompter. These are questions and answers. I don't have a lot of time to think about it. Was this really the best answer I could have given? But I got to tell you, I'm not sure I wouldn't give exactly the same answer again. Here's what I said. For better or for worse, I said, thank you for your question. Let me put it this way. If I could save one logger's job and make it possible for one logger to go home and have presents for his children this Christmas, instead of having to say he's out of work. And to do that, I would have to hook up six spotted owls to a car battery and electrocute them. I would only have this to say. Can somebody tell me which side is positive? Well, there was a gasp of horror, and there were a few guilty chuckles, but that's what I said. I said, if I could save one logger's job by hooking up a whole bunch of spotted owls to a car battery. Again, look, I'm not a guy who goes around killing spotted owls. I could not shoot birds. Literally couldn't. Okay, apart from the fact that I have a religious problem with it. But I once went on a hunt with somebody, and there were a few people, and he insisted I came along, and he was very proud. He gave me a family shotgun, and then at a certain point, they had people driving birds out and so on, and I shot away from the birds. I can't do it. If I was going to eat the bird, that would be different, but to just shoot them for sport, couldn't do it. But that said, I believe that and here I'm being honest. If I could save a human being's job, if I could let a man retain his dignity by his wife and his children, and to do that I had to shoot a pheasant, I'd do it. I would. And so I was being truthful in that I made it, you know, I framed it in a frivolous way. And when I said, you know, I would only be, all I would say is which end is positive, meaning I would with alacrity do that. I got into a lot of trouble for that, a lot of trouble. But trouble is this rabbi's middle name, otherwise known as Rabbi Daniel Lapp. And quick break, be back with you in a moment.
Revealing how the world really works. This is Rabbi Daniel Lapin, on demand on the Blaze Radio Network. Don't miss the Morning Blaze with Doc and Skip.
We are backing different groups that are fighting each other in the Middle East. There is no justification for this. I don't care how difficult the situation is or all the particulars. There is no justification. If this is going on, then somebody needs to come up with a better plan. Period. Well, Doc, it's more difficult. You don't understand. Tell you what, smart guy, come up with a better damn plan than us funding these groups that are fighting other ones.
The Morning Blaze with Doc and Skip. Weekday mornings, 6 to 9 Eastern on the Blaze Radio Network. Welcome back to the Blaze Radio Network On Demand with Rabbi Daniel Lapin.
Well, here we are again, and the website is youneedarabbi.com. Youneeda, rabbi, rabbi.com. Youneedarabbi.com. And love you to head over there. I want you to subscribe to my free weekly email, Thought Tools. That way we stay in touch, and that way you get a free weekly spiritual strategy that you can employ in social, family, faith areas, finance areas. And also take a look at the store. That is where the resource and products that I create, this is my business, that's what I do, and those are resources that can materially make a difference to you in your life, and if they fit you and fit your purposes, then you'll want to buy them. This is called an advertisement. May not be a very good advertisement, but it is an advertisement nonetheless, and that makes it a good thing, not a bad thing. We all, I think, like knowing the ways in which our fellow human beings can help us, can improve our lives. This is one of the reasons that when people are given the option to have advertising literature stopped from being mailed to them, you know, there's a list, you can do that. You know, everyone talks about online. But in the actual, you know, the mailers that come in your mail, the catalogs and the overwhelming majority of people who get given the offer to be taken off, decline. And I'm among them. I like getting that stuff in the mail. I like it. I really don't care if another tree had to get chopped down to make that catalog. It's fine. They'll plant another one in its place. It's called agriculture. And you can do agriculture with corn and with wheat and with sunflowers and, yes, with trees as well. Trees are not holy, as much as the left likes to pretend that they are, and it's fascinating because the Bible foresaw a time when people would worship trees, which brings us back to the main topic. So I'll leave you with a website. I really would like you to do me a favor and spend a little bit of time there and perhaps even a little bit of money there, only if there's something there that'll really be useful to you. I'm not asking you for charity. I'm only asking you to use my resources if you think and believe that they will be valuable to you, deliver value to you. If not, then God bless you. That's fine. You know, there's a lot of different people in this world, and there's a lot of different ways of communicating and conveying information. There are people for whom my approach works real well, but there are also, and heaven knows, even as a congregational rabbi in California, there were plenty of people who tried out my congregation, didn't care for it, and chose to worship somewhere else. And in the same way, there were many, many people who came from not only from California, but from different parts of the country to settle in Los Angeles in order to be able to worship at my congregation, Pacific Jewish Center, in Los Angeles, on the beach, actually, in the Venice, Santa Monica area. That's where we were. And I understood that I was very effective and very helpful for some people, and not at all effective and not very helpful for others. That's how it is, in exactly the same way that there are a lot of different stores where you can buy socks. Right? Why? You know, the way the Soviets did it and the way any socialistic system does it is, hey, socks is socks. Here's a store. This is a government place. This is where you go for your socks, right? Just like the military does it. You go to that window to get your uniform. That's all there is to it. But that's not how God created us. We're created to exploit the infinite variety of human beings. And some people want to get socks at Macy's. Some people want to get socks at Walmart or Target or Nordstrom's or thousands of other different ways to buy socks or places to buy socks. Every place is different, and each place appeals to a different type of person. End of story. And so for those people that for whom I am useful, for people who find the particular approach that I possess to be helpful, wonderful, then please go ahead and use it. And so I was explaining why it is that the president is comfortable saying that the greatest threat facing America is climate change, at a time when economically we're in bad shape, internationally, China is on the march, ISIS is causing its problems, the whole Islamic world is causing, and in the face of all this, climate change is the big problem. What's going on here? So I started off by explaining the power of faith, the extent to which people who are on the outside think it to be completely illogical. People on the outside think that the human of faith is doing things that make no sense. And so you can be quite sure that many people, including many secularized Jews, came up to these immigrants in the 1920s in New York or in Galveston or in Dallas and said to them, your family is going to lose their apartment. They're going to be thrown out because you're not able to pay the rent. And your children are not getting fed sufficiently nutritiously. It's all very nice that you believe in the Sabbath and you believe the fourth commandment. But you know what? It doesn't make sense. In the face of a hungry, homeless family, or you know what? You're just going to have to suck it up and work on the Sabbath. That's all you're going to have to do. Come on, don't be an idiot. You got to do the sensible thing here. Doesn't that sound very plausible? It does, right? And I'm sure that it increased the suffering immeasurably for many of these people. Because particularly if somebody's cruel enough to, you know, say that in front of your family, how do you look at your family and say no? The only thing is that in many of those cases, I know for a fact, the wives and the children themselves said, Papa, you don't have to worry, we'll be fine, but no one in this family is working on the Sabbath. Okay. The point I'm making is, it looks illogical, right? Somebody might say to me, come with us on a cruise next year. And I'll say, you know what, that's just not in my budget. I've got to tell you, it's just not in my budget. The person says, would you like to do a cruise with us? I say, yeah, I'd love to go on a cruise. Never done it. Now, in truth of fact, I wouldn't, because you know, my dear friends, that I do not go on boats that I'm not captaining. Okay? Just want to make that clear. If I go on a boat, that's me in the wheelhouse. Okay, I do not go on boats as a passenger. And the friend says, well, why so come with us on a cruise next summer? And I say, well, I really would, but it's just not in my budget. He says, look, let me tell you something. I know how much meat you eat, and I know the difference in the price between kosher meat and non-kosher meat. I've done a little calculation. If you really want to come on the cruise with us, I can show you how you can do it without costing you a penny. I say, oh, really? How's that? He says, all you've got to do is switch to non-kosher meat. Look how much you'll save. And with all this money you'll save, by next summer, you'll have enough to buy a ticket on the cruise for you and your wife. Okay, now, word aside to you, I haven't done the arithmetic. I'm not sure that that's exactly correct, but you get the idea. And so what do I say? I say to him, look, as much as I want to go on a cruise, that's not an option. He says, Lappin, you're being illogical. This doesn't make sense. I mean, this kosher food's all very nice, and I understand you like it. Big deal. So for a little while, you won't have kosher food. You know what? After the cruise, you can go back to kosher food. And I look like an idiot to him because I persist in my refusal to do that. In exactly the same way that these Jews of Dallas and Galveston and New York and Boston and Baltimore in the early years of the 20th century suffered terribly the indignity and pain of not being able to provide for their families because the economic climate was such that if you didn't work on Saturday, you did not get a job. End of story. And people would come to them and say, come on, be logical, be sensible. And they said, look, I know I'm being illogical, and I don't expect you to understand, but that is not an option. And the point is, my friends, that environmentalism is a religion. It's a faith-based system. And they love being able to quote, you know, 90% of scientists, 70% of scientists agree. That's all rubbish. It's not true. All of that is not true. And again, I'm not going to walk you through the details on this, not because they're not available to me, but because time is short. And if you're interested or you have any doubts about this, if you have any part of you that thinks, oh, we really are all going to have to learn to swim because Miami Beach is going to be underwater and Manhattan is going to be half its size as the water rises. If any of you believe that nonsense, and you really want to know the truth, if you yourself haven't drunk the Kool-Aid and you want the truth, if you yourself haven't subscribed to that religion and you want the truth, believe me, it's out there. It's readily available. And honestly, if you have any trouble getting hold of it, contact me and I'll direct you to places of scrupulous and unchallengeable scholarship and scientific credibility. You don't have to worry. You really don't have to worry. The sea levels are not rising in any way at all that has to worry you or your children or your grandchildren or your great-grandchildren. And after that, let them worry about it. But this, my friends, is a religion. And that's why it is that the president gets up and says, the most serious threat facing America is climate change. Mr. Obama, you're being illogical. What are you talking about? It makes no sense. It does. You can't say you're being illogical to somebody about his faith. Of course he's being illogical. It's a faith. That's the whole point. That is what it's all about. And it's a faith that is based on secularism. Right? What do I mean? Well, why am I not worried about it? First of all, I've seen the crookery. I've seen the bogus science. I've seen the dishonesty among scientists. I've seen the way that this is all tied up with government, and government grants to scientists are linked into their commitment to maintaining the orthodox doctrine on climate change. I've researched this extensively, and I've satisfied myself beyond any shadow of a doubt that this is entirely a belief system which is used to essentially justify redistribution, not only redistribution within America, but internationally, redistribution from so-called wealthy countries to poor countries, but that really isn't what it's all about. And above all, it's a hatred for technological advance, because that presupposes human beings as being capable of creativity, which depends on them being created by a god of creation. And so the bottom line, I'm not worried, because I know that God created human beings and put them on this planet with a special plan for their destiny, which does not include being drowned by rising seawater. So I'm not worried, not in the slightest. But I'm also not worried because I've studied the bogus science and the hoaxes that otherwise you would have thought reputable and respectable scientists seem to have no trouble inflicting on their colleagues and on their students. And so I'm not in the least bit worried about the environmental crisis, because there isn't one. But the truth is that if, on the other hand, your worldview is based on secularism, that means there's no God, that means human beings are here on the planet, but since no God put us here, the only possible alternative is that we are here because of a lengthy process of unaided materialistic evolution that transformed primitive protoplasm into plumbers and professors. If that's the case, then we truly here are here only as part of a physical materialistic process. That means that there is no supervisory intelligence, which means that we are constantly facing all kinds of crises. Worse than that, optimism and hope springs fundamentally from faith. It's a very important point I'm making. Optimism and hope springs fundamentally from faith. Secularism almost invariably produces a downward mood. Secularism almost invariably produces a sense of, we better do something. And I think of that very often as the do-something disease. Whereas religion and religious conservatives, by the way, take time to settle back and just give thanks for the many blessings of life. They just are grateful for so much. And we look at the sunshine and we look at our friends and our family. And yes, we've all got problems and we've all got challenges, but there are also moments of supreme beauty and times of great joy. And we just enjoy those. But secularists, secular fundamentalists or liberal extremists are constantly unhappy. They're constantly needing revolution. They're constantly needing change. They're constantly needing to fix that which isn't broken. That is their religious obsession. And ladies and gentlemen, that means that we are just about at the end of the time that we have together. Did I say, ladies and gentlemen, do I subscribe to a binary sexual structure in society? Hey, you better believe it. So enjoy one another, and there is only time left for me to say that until next week, I wish you 7 days of health and prosperity. I'm Rabbi Daniel Lappin. God bless you.
The Blaze on Demand.
This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin.
The founder of this company, 10 years ago, was trying to sell his house and went through real estate agent after real estate agent, and they were all talking a great game. And this guy who is selling his house, the founder of this company, he's, you know, he's kind of an important guy and kind of, you know, should get the best treatment. And he said to his wife, if this is what it's like for us, how do people who have no clout ever get around this? So he started a company and it went into business, I think, 3 years ago. Their deal is their word is their bond and they are just like you. Now, how can I say that? Because I'm the founder of the company. We have 1,000 agents across the country, and they are people that listen to this show. And so when you go through Real Estate Agents I Trust, it's sent to somebody who already, you already know their sensibilities. They already are cut from exactly the same cloth. There's got to be a better way. There is. RealEstateAgentsITrust.com.